3 years ago, in 2012, a crack duo, one martial arts expert and surprisingly good mimic, the other a weapons specialist and professionally bearded, were sent to separate recording stations thousands of miles apart to do an 80s and 90s action commentary podcast for a crime they happily committed. Something James Spader told them about that involved an industrial drum of coconut butter hand lotion and a common household whisk. These men promptly created a passion-filled wave of action adoration that swept throughout the internet underground. Today, still wanted by Steven Seagal for making one too many jokes about his expanding gut and knitted hair, they survive as podcasters of fortune. If you love action, if no one else can help, and if you can find them, maybe you should be listening to Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid Commentaries. This podcast, people, explodes!
Hello, and welcome to Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid Commentary Podcast. Although it's not a commentary this week, it's a kick-ass interview. I am Dr. Action.
And I am the Kick-Ass Kid. And yes, as Dr. Action alluded to in his intro, we have a special action interview episode for you with none other than stuntman turned film director Jesse Johnson, who has done some incredibly awesome work, which we get into in this following conversation. Thanks ever so much, Jesse, for agreeing to be on the show. You're talking with me, John Cross. I also go by the Kick-Ass Kid on the show. And also on the line, we have Dr. Action himself, Doc Paul Croson.
How are you, Mr. Johnson?
Good. Good, Doc. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Thank you.
Obviously, thanks ever so much for agreeing to talk to us today. And so we just wanted to start off. You started off in the 90s as a stuntman and worked on a succession of very cool, high-profile films. How did you get started as a stunt performer?
Very sad, I'm afraid. It's complete nepotism. My uncle in the business at the time, Vic Armstrong, who's my uncle, I actually worked with him since I was about 14, drawing storyboards and carrying his stunt bag. I skipped school and worked with him on Young Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, which was, way back in the 80s, and I was 14 and carried his stunt bag, so... It was Simon Crane was one of the stuntmen on that. He's now one of the top second unit guys in town, and it was really the birthplace of a lot of the English coordinators are out there doing great stuff now. So it was a fantastic, and obviously it was an incredible movie to be on, and that was pretty much the bug at that point. It had bitten pretty resolutely, and there's no real looking back from there. And school took a second position to working with him, and whenever I could. It was obviously tougher when he was out of the country, but certainly within the UK, following around and learning the ropes, which was what he did and what you used to do in the old days. But I people do it less now with film schools, and every so often I sit down and wish I'd done the film school method. But there you go. You don't get a do-over, do you?
No. But, I mean, you can't look back and regret any of the choices, considering the fantastic career you had.
Well, it was fabulous, but I mean, for the longest time, I was simply worried about eating and had to just keep working and working and working because there was a PA position that didn't pay very much at all. So and then suddenly something happens around your sort of 20s where you realize you're actually working with these incredible talents and it's worth watching them. And at that point, it was almost a concerted effort to start picking up whatever I could and learning from them. And it actually takes an effort because you can just work on movie after movie and and you emerge from it without any sort of great lessons learned. And you spot people who worked against you forever, and really doesn't, it's no indicator they could direct a movie, but actually watching the people you work with and adapting to them and seeing what they're doing, the techniques they're using to get out of a problem, it takes an effort, but as well, there is a film school to be had on the job, so to speak, I think. I believe it. I had a 2008 stock market crash, the hedge fund crash. Mm. I had three big movies fall apart, and at that time I was full-time directing. I wasn't doing stunts at all. I'd given up and given my stunt bag away, and these three huge movies that fell apart caused me to have, I had to go out and get my stunt bag back and throw my shingle out as a stunt performer again. And for that year or so, catching up financially, it was, I think it was The Master, with P.T. Anderson, Lincoln with Steven Spielberg, and Thor with Kenneth Branagh. And I'm sitting next to the monitor, next to the camera with these guys, watching and listening. And I suddenly realized this is probably the best thing that could ever happen to me, having to literally go back to doing this. I've had one of the most wonderful postgraduate doctorate courses in what it really means to be a director. And and at the time, I was panicking because, oh, my God, I'm not directing. I'm back doing stunts. But you suddenly realize it's a really, really wonderful, wonderful position to be in on a film set because you're so close to them. You're helping with the safety. You're throwing ideas backwards and forwards. You know, what's going to work action-wise. You're listening to their particular technique. And it's a really, really privileged place to be, you know. And it was funny, doing it a second time made me realize that more profoundly than before.
Oh yeah, definitely. You know, that's fascinating.
You work with someone like Kenneth Branagh, who's obsessed with the performance, and he's got a little notebook. And as he's watching the scene play out on the monitor, he's making copious notes, tons of them. I was looking over his shoulder, what on earth is he noting? You know,
yeah.
And he was making notes for each of the characters' performances and what he wanted to change, what he liked, and he'd dash in on cut and go through the scene, you know, whether Natalie Portman and Chris Hemsworth, and literally tell them, and you're looking, oh, God, that's an awful lot of information, and you're wondering if the actor's actually listening or sort of nodding or just liking the attention. I think it's sort of a combination of all three, you know. And then with P.T. Anderson, you've got, you know, he really, really ran the set, and it was, I'd always thought it's the actors that were the ones that Stanislavski, I'm going to be the one that's in character, but it was completely him. I mean, they were sort of playing along and enjoying it, but it was absolutely one. The idea of that immersive environment was all down to him. It's fantastic to watch. You know, we weren't allowed to call Joaquin. You had to call him Freddy. You know, everyone on set, even the extras, had to call. You know, had to act as if he were in character.
Wow.
And that was a really interesting thing to be a part of. The guy I worked with, Garrett, made a fundamental error on that set. There was one scene where he did something and he did it a little quick, and Garrett said, "Oh, don't worry, we can slow that down in post." And it was like someone had pulled the needle off a record player midway through the song. Everyone turned around and looked at it. It's like, do it in post. We don't do anything in post. It happens in the camera on set, or it doesn't happen at all. And right. That was awesome as well. You know, so nowadays, so much it's, you know, fixed in post. You know, do it with sure. Visual effects. Don't worry about it. We'll finish it later. And to go back to someone that was shooting on, you know, 65mm film, you know, to be blown up to 70mm, and the absolute, you know, the absolute antithesis of modern technology, but making it look beautiful. I found that really, really interesting and educational, you know. So it's a good place to learn the craft, but it took me a while to realize it was a good place to learn the craft. Let's put it that way. Stunts.
Yeah. Oh, excellent, excellent.
So were there any favourite stunts you performed that stand out, or any favourite films that you worked on, stunt-wise?
Well, stunt-wise, those two I just mentioned had to be the most favourite because it came at such a, you know, such an important time in my life. Having directed, probably at that point, I'd done about 7 or 8 movies that had gone straight to DVD. I thought of myself as a working director, and then being forced to go back to stunts, and literally having to turn my attitude around and realise it wasn't a failed position, but it was actually an incredible position, you know, fortune to be there. Those are obviously ones that are very, very important for me in terms of they're exciting. But the other one, you know, the other ones, you know, so much of being a stuntman is not as glamorous as you hear this all the time, I'm sure, but it's really about making things as safe as possible, trying to minimize it and trying to make it something you can do over and over again. Obviously, there's always an element, you know, you always run into that stunt where you've got to, you know, it's basically, you're looking in the cameras there and someone's about to say, actually, you've got to grit your teeth because you know it's going to hurt. There's plenty of those that come along too, even when you try and minimize the, you know, the risk involved. It's inherently, at its core, you know, it's inherently can be dangerous. So you have to be on point. So those are exciting moments. But I was lucky. I was not a guy that did 600-foot high falls. I didn't particularly do any of the big water stunts or anything, you know, monstrous. But you know, there was a lot of fun ones. I think Cutthroat Island, which was sadly a failure as a movie, was actually an incredibly fun film to work on. You know, you're dressed as pirates for 3.5 months. You go from Malta to southern Thailand, and then you're out in the China Sea for a month and a half. It takes an hour to get to the location by catamaran. It was pretty fun. That was an exciting adventure to be on. I directed a film called The Fifth command with Rick Yoon and Joaquin Woodbine that shot in Bangkok, Thailand, and I was there for 5 months. And that was one of those situations where you get off the plane and it's you and a Thai crew and Thai heads of department, and you basically just got to immerse yourself in the culture and learn as much of the language as you can, and try and get them to make as close to the movie you want as possible, and that, you know, adapting to their way of making movies. For me, that's some of the most exciting stuff to do. But you're right, you're asking that stunt, you wasn't asking that directing.
That's great. I love The Fifth Commandment. It's a great film.
Thank you very much. Yeah, that's a hard one for me.
I actually picked that up recently. I saw it, and it wasn't, although I loved it, it wasn't actually until looking into doing this interview and researching the interview that I was like, oh, I love that movie, and you directed that one as well. Because I think the one that I was came aware of you particularly was The Package, which we'll talk about down the road. But no, The Fifth Commandment is fantastic. I do enjoy that movie.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it was very, very tough. I mean, you're entering an environment where everything is foreign, you know, and the way they make movies is slightly different. It ended up being something I loved and really, really enjoyed, and had an enormous amount of respect for the Thai crew at the end of it. They're very dedicated. But you know, as a film gets lower budget in the US, the crew gets smaller and smaller, you know, and I made the last one. I made The Beautiful Ones, which is a very indeed black and white semi-art film, has action in it. But we had, you know, 8 or 9 people on the crew at times. On The Fifth Commandment, I would turn around. We were doing a talking scene between two actors, maybe a single camera. I'd turn around, and there'd be nearly 90 or 100 crew members there. And it was just mind-boggling. You'd see all these faces looking at you. And they just have an awful lot more people to do things. You know, you have people carrying cable. You have people carrying, you know. It's, you know, and I don't know whether, I don't think they all come by car. They all come, you know, public transport, but it's very intimidating thing to turn around and see this huge wall of people all involved in making the film, and people a little getting used to. But extras were very cheap, so we had scenes with 700 extras in, 300 extras, 100 extras, and it was really, really fun to work on that scale on The Fifth Commandment. The stunts were interesting, and getting the guys' heads around how to do this kind of stuff was. It was a really, really educational and wonderful sort of experience. A little bit like being, you know, Joseph Conrad's law gym for about 3 or 4 months, where you become a warrior chief. You know, obviously you're not going to war, but you're having to get a huge amount of people to, you know, who are all there, you know, and want to help, but still, you know, they would go if you gave no direction, they would go the opposite direction for the direction you wanted, just because that's sort of a default position. It's a very strange thing.
Right.
But it's a fun one to do, and a lot of logistics, and it wouldn't happen without Rick Yoon, who's a powerhouse of discipline and control at the head of the ship, but certainly all the action that I came up with and making it happen was fun, you know. Wandering around the locations and seeing if you'd come up with it would work. Be exciting there, and you know, then solving that with that. It really is a fun thing to do. You know, it's a wonderful, wonderful playset that you have as a director.
Yeah,
I'm glad you like that.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, we're big fans of sort of all different types of action films and drama films and stuff. So when it's a film like that, that's good and kinetic and fun and exciting and lots of stuff going on. Then it's bound to be on our list.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I took a little break away from action with The Beautiful Ones, which is more character driven. It was black and white. The point of doing that one, I directed 10 movies that had gone straight to DVD, with the exception of The Package, which had a limited theatrical, but it was basically a DVD movie in classic shape, and I just felt there was more to what I wanted to do. So what I decided to do with the black and white picture was, you know, when you direct a DVD movie, you have a criteria, an MO, you know, a mandate that comes from the sales agent, and it's usually about 6 or 8 things. You can't do this, you can't do that. Don't stay too long on this shot. No violence. Where you hang on the violence, and I decided I wanted to make a film that basically defied all of those 10 mandates. And so I did that with The Beautiful Ones. And I don't know if we'll ever be able to sell it, but it's a fun, fun picture. But right now, my next picture, I'm ready to go back to doing what I love and what I adore, and what I feel I'm best at, which is action. I have a meeting with Scott Adkins later this morning, straight after this telephone call with you guys.
Wow.
We're having coffee across the street, and I want him in the next picture. I've just got to, you know,
we want you to have him in the next picture.
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
He did a little film for me a long time ago called Pit Fighter, which was my first film, and he came on and did a little part in that, and I think he may even have not had his work permit to work in America. I think we just snuck him onto the set at Universal, threw him in, gave him some dialogue, and we got on very well. And we've been talking about a film for the last 10 years, and we've had scripts sent to us. And, you know, it usually goes like this. Scott wants to do it if you direct it, and I want to do it if Scott's in it. We read the script, and both of us look at each other and goes, this isn't the one. This isn't the one for us to do it. And it's like, okay, let's move on. Let's wait till the good one comes along. And I think we found one that works for both of us. And I think it will be phenomenal. It will be my coming out movie. And I hope it will be his one in terms of theatrical, US domestic, you know, because at the moment he has a very rabid following internationally, but less of a following here domestically in the US. And I think that's wrong, you know.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, yeah, no, we both watched Ninja 2, Shadow of a Tear, and were just, you know, why isn't this on, you know, 3,000 screens? I mean, the what him and Isaac Florentine does on that movie,
yeah, exactly,
is incredible. You know, especially when you compare,
exactly,
it to...
Isaac and I talk about this all the time. I love Isaac. I'm a huge fan of him. I think he's fantastic. He's very, very kind to me. He set me up with different distributors. He took one of my scripts in the early days and helped get it seen. He's one of... And by the way, that's extraordinarily rare for a director to help another director, for obvious reasons. There's only one director per movie. But right. he is one of those very rare souls who is giving, generous, helpful, and is not scared, is not worried and concerned. He knows he has a talent. He knows he's very, very good at that, and he doesn't, you know, he'll help other people. You know, I have more respect for him than many, many so-called A-list directors are working out there at the moment. And if there were any justice in this business, which sadly there isn't, as we all know, he would be making theatrical movies, and so would Scott. But I'm hoping this one that we do together will be the one that sort of breaks down that invisible barrier and, you know,
yes,
gets him to notice. Because, I mean, you know, Scott's got the looks, he's got the talent as an actor, and he's more than qualified as an actual, yeah, performer.
It's kind of sick, the old really, days, isn't it?
Yeah, in the old days, that would have been enough, you know. We're just dealing with a strange market at the moment, which has become almost ludicrous in its sort of necessity of having an A-list actor in there. So what happens is we end up spending half of the budget for Bruce Willis or twice the budget on Bruce Willis, making the film for $200,000, and he works for 2 days, which is absurd. You know, he's wonderful, but you can't make a great movie that way, you know.
Yeah.
And this is not the way to make good movies. And there's going to be an end to this formula because the films are not good, you know.
Yeah.
So we have to get out there with people like Scott and make fantastic movies, because ultimately there will always be a market for good movies.
Definitely. You know, we thought when the whole Scott Adkins for Batman thing went round the internet, we were kind of hoping that, no, we didn't think he'd be Batman, but we kind of hoped that would give him some sort of higher profile and give him a bit of a chance, just in internet chatter and stuff.
I think it did. I think with things like that, you won't notice until he gets that big movie, and then people will say, well, he came onto our radar first with that, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the interesting thing about success. It's happening. You just don't realize it until that final straw, you know, breaks it. And then it's like, yeah, no, well, we first heard about him during, you know, Warner's first heard about him during that whole thing for Batman, you know, because they do. They have people watching. They have people watching the internet. They have people following that trends.
Sure.
You know, and they do know. You've just got to become so overwhelmingly popular if you decide to do it that way that they literally cannot not take notice. And for example, with the Mortal Kombat reboot, where, you know, they initially started out by suing Kevin, and then suddenly said, oh shit, this has become so popular, we look like idiots if we sue him, let's make a miniseries out of it, you know.
Yeah.
Which is awesome. It's one of those wonderful stories, but they happen very rarely. They have to be so overwhelmingly popular, you know. You guys are familiar with those ones, of course.
Yeah. And, you know, we just think that obviously Isaac and Scott, they have that, like Gareth Evans and Iko Uwais, like they have that great partnership and they're making some great movies. And obviously you've done some great films and we can't wait to see you and Scott work together as well. That's great. So how did you make the transition into directing? Was it actually something you always wanted to do and you did the stunts
I've been hungry as a very, very hungry MF, like from the very, very start. You know, I was directing music videos in the UK at 17. Every time I got a little bit of cash together, it was spent on, you know, Arriflex ST cameras that we buy from Shepherd's Bush, you know, where the Indian guys sell them. You know, the stuff that went from the BBC to India and then came back to Shepherd's Bush and they're selling it back to, you know, the film students. I bought my first Arriflex there. We made films on standard 16, music videos, whatever we could, short films. So, you know, my first stunt job was, you know, where I actually got paid contractually was Total Recall, which is Mexico City in, I think, 1989, right?
Yeah.
So I came back from that one, and I used that money to make a short film, which won a few awards, and it was there. It was always the... And Vic, I've talked to him, my uncle Vic Armstrong, and I talked to him, he said when he was a stuntman, he just wanted to be the best stuntman. When he became a second unit director, he just wanted to be the best unit director. And I was so admiring of that, because that definitely wasn't me. I just wanted to be a director right from the get-go, you know.
Yeah.
And everything else was a means to an end. I loved stunt work, and I enjoy it. I enjoy the science behind the stunts, you know, in terms of finding something extraordinarily dangerous that the director wants, and then being able to come up with that, being able to calm people down, being able to take over a meeting of very, very intelligent, very confident adults, you know, who've been in the business a long time, be able to take over that meeting and take them from sheer panic to the comfort and ease. And now they know how it's happening. And now they're happy. And now the insurance company is happy. And now the producers are happy. And then the actor, who's quite often the equivalent of a highly strung racehorse pony, you know, is nervous about how you're going to do this, and now you have to take him down, you have to calm him and explain how it's going to happen methodically, without a lot of emotion, without an awful lot of sort of hyperbole, and you bring them down, and then you see that look of calm come over their face when they suddenly realize, wow, not only is it safe, but I'm going to look like a badass too.
Yeah.
And this is exciting, this is fun, and this is learning to deal with actors. It's learning to deal with it, you know, they you don't talk to them like a normal person, you talk to them in a way that they grasp with regard to their character, with regard to their standing, and that's, you know, that was extraordinarily important to me, and enjoyed it an awful lot. So it was always, but always at the back of my head was, you know, how the fuck am I going to direct? How am I going to get this guy? Is this guy going to be in one of my movies at some point? Let's make sure that's a you know, relationship that I can come back to. You know, it was always there, and it was a motivator. And I'm sort of ashamed to admit it, because as I say, I'd love to be like, you know, the old school, you know, just, you know, move on to the next job methodically, but I never was. Every opportunity I got, I would take off and make a short, whether it be a low budget movie or a trailer, you know, or a music video or a commercial, that, you know, shooting for spec and any angle I could, you know, to every residual check that came in that was more than enough to pay the rent. If there was any left over at the end, it would be spent on making a movie, you know. And that's, you know, that was my training ground, you know. Sure. There's nothing like spending your own money to teach you how to be careful with your budget.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
You know, I try not to now, but it happens. You know, it always happens. And, you know, if I read about my heroes, you know, Francis Coppola, George Lucas, Peckinpahs, you know, it was more than, you were always more than a mercenary. There's always a certain amount of mercenary to some of them, and the way they would, and, you know, tell their life story in anecdotal form, it would sound like it was mercenary. But if you peel the onion layer away, you realize there was just an incredible love for the craft. And at the end of the day, if you haven't worked for a year and a job comes along, you're going to be able to try and make something good of that job, because you need that job and you want that job, because it's more than just work, you know. And that's something I realized from the get-go. And consequently probably said yes to a few films I perhaps shouldn't. But, you know, if I define the films that I wish I perhaps hadn't directed, and I could go back in time and not do those, I would have lost out on many opportunities that came through them, you know, and that's the funny thing about the business, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to mention those films, because the people involved would be terribly, terribly upset to know that I was ashamed of them, but but there are one or two there that I always cringe when people mention. But it's fine. I think that's part of the adventure, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, I don't think it'll be one of them. But Eric Roberts has been a mainstay in movies for years, and one of my favorite of his films is The Butcher, which he directed.
I love you. You're fantastic.
Yeah. How was Eric Roberts to work with?
Eric's wonderful. He's in the Beautiful Ones. I'm working with him next week as well. I'm bringing him in for a music video. He was someone I loved. One of the most influential films on me as a young man was a film called Runaway Train, which I just thought was incredible.
Film.
In its you know, an epic film made about an extraordinarily simple story. You know, the film manages to be epic. You know, which is you know, in pure cinema terms, that's very, very difficult to pull off. And I you know, and then part of Greenwich Village and all the pictures he did from there.
Best of the best.
Best of the best, of course. which are wonderful pictures. And you know, he's you know, at the time, we were very upset when we hired him. We had expected to get a bigger name. You know, it came down to, guys, you've got to film this, you've got to have a cast member. And we had this list of 14 actors with Eric as the last name on that list.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you know, if all fails, we'll hire Eric. And then it all failed. Eric. And so I was terribly, you know, terribly, terribly disappointed. But then once we started working with him, I found a human there, a character, someone who loved movies, had great stories and was willing to get into it, and you know, he became a friend, which often is the case when, you know, when you're warned about someone, like, he's gonna be difficult, he's gonna be tough, and you go, and then he ends up being wonderful. Just needs to be someone that's listened to, needs to be someone that's directed, worked with, you know. I thought he brought an awful lot to that picture, and
I think it's one of his best
performances. I've fired him, you know, 2 or 3 times since then. So that's, you know, I like to work with actors I know how to work with, you know.
Yeah.
It's not so much the laziness or comfort zone, but that has a certain amount to do with it. But it's also, if you know someone and you have a shorthand and an ability to communicate with them, you can push into unknown territories together more easily than perhaps if it's a stranger you're working with and you're not sure where they're going to be. You know, if it's something that requires a leap of faith, for example, The Beautiful Ones, which is the film I just finished, I wrote for Rossum Call, who I'd worked with in Green Street Hooligans Part 2. We got on very, very well on that picture. The picture was very, very difficult. There was a lot of rewriting, you know, usually 15 minutes before we shot the scene. And he helped an awful lot with that. And wherever that film ended up in terms of your estimation, take my word for it, where it started out on paper was far, far worse. And it was brought to where we made it. And as far as I'm concerned, it was a huge achievement to get it where we had it. I wish it could have gone even further and become even more wonderful, but you know, it's, you know, films are made over 16 days and that's it, baby, that's all you get. But my relationship with Ross was such that I wrote another script for him, knowing that we could push even further into a territory that we didn't know about because we had this familiarity. And I think we've done really, really good work in The Beautiful One. So I'm excited for you to see that. Could you find the trailer online? Did you see that? At least have a taste of it. If you go to my website, jessevjohnson.com, it's on the front page there. You just click on it.
Oh, great. Okay.
We shall share that on the group page.
Great. He's fab. He was on, say, Band of Brothers, which I think everyone remembers him for, and then the TV show Crash, and then White Collar. He's an awesome English guy. So we're hoping to do something with an English kind of release on that. You know, talking with the sales company that will actually help us push that a little bit.
Okay, cool.
English boys coming home. I don't know.
Yeah, if there is a release either in America or England, let us know, and we'll Doc's in England, so he can go see it there, or I'm in America. If we've got both
fantastic
nations covered, so
yeah, we've got
very,
you back.
Very good.
So
I was very lucky on that film. I managed to get Ed Lauter in. Are you guys familiar with him?
Oh yeah, no, I know Ed Lauter. Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah. We're not sure if it's his last film or second from last. But he was obviously very, very ill when we worked with him. But he's absolutely fantastic in the movie. And boy, oh boy, talk about anecdotes. I mean, just wonderful. Lee Marvin, you know, Charles Bronson stories. It was just great working with him. I love it when you get to, you know, I think that's the other reason I like Eric so much, is, you know, you get these stories about John Huston, about working with Bob Fosse, and all these cats who I'm a huge fan of. And you have this first-hand anecdotal sort of, storytelling, which is wonderful. It makes me feel that I was there. For the longest time, I was trying to hire as many crew members as I could that had worked with or for Steve McQueen, with Sam Peckinpah, who is someone that I wanted to hear.
Yeah.
How did he handle this? How did he do this? How did he run his sets? And that's the wonderful thing about this game. You know, you grow up in England reading all these books on directors and movies, which is my film school. I was buying as many, many books from secondhand bookstores as I could. You'd become fascinated with the A director. I had 7 books on Peckinpah, I think I've got 9 or 10 on John Ford, and you read them cover to cover, and then you come to the US and you work as a PA, and you realize that grip or that gaffer or that makeup person worked with him on 7 or 8 movies. You get to sit with them and hear the stories, and that was probably one of the most precious aspects of learning the ropes here as a young PA/AD, then obviously turning to stunts after that as well, which was a blast.
Yeah, and definitely, and you've sort of been around since filmmaking was still being done traditionally, with a camera and a big crew and all the rest of it, and practical stunts and practical all the way through to sort of present day with, we want to talk a little later about where filmmaking is going. But also on your another point where you were saying about working with the same kind of people, I know casual film viewers might not realize, but certainly me as a fanboy and other people I know, we love the idea of a community. Like, we love the idea of people working with the same kind of group again, and we love the idea of there being, especially Doc and I, like an action community or a martial arts community or a stunt community where people come together and they're working on the same stuff and they all have sharing ideas and things. And I think it adds something to the finished article. I think it adds something to
I think it's enormous. I found it by accident, and then when you analyze it, it makes complete sense. There's a writer director called Mike Hurst. He's from England. He's over here. He rewrites, critiques, kicks my ass on everything that I write or direct. I've made him a producer for the last 3 movies that I produced or directed.
Yeah.
He's an ex martial arts fighter as well, but he's, and you have to. And then Isaac Florentine, and then I have a stunt collaborator called Luke LaFontaine, who's a sword master, martial artist, fight choreographer, who I work with pretty much consistently over the last 8 or 9 years. And then there's the MC Monkeys, who are Johnny Yang's team of martial artists. They make a lot of short movies, but they're breaking into bigger and bigger movies through me and through my family and through other coordinators, and just doing phenomenal, phenomenal work. Do you know those guys, the MC Monkeys?
Not by name, but I'm sure we've seen lots of films with them.
They've done a lot of work for Machinima. They did Sleeping Dogs, which is a short film that got huge, huge attention. A Chinese martial arts style picture shot here. I think that was how I discovered them, and then brought them on for... I've had them work for me. And you bounce these ideas back, and you innovate together, and you push the boundaries, and you look at each other, and you copy from each other, you're inspired by each other, and then you try and outdo each other. It's the perfect way of doing it, and it has to happen. It has to happen. You look at our heroes. You look at the USC group. For example, and of course, I'm not making a comparison between our talents, but you look at Manilius, Francis Coppola and George Lucas together, they critiqued and argued, and the worst thing in the world you can do is surround yourself by a bunch of guys that say, "That's great, boss, wonderful."
Right, exactly.
They keep pushing.
It really is. And in the same respect, when I have my default actor, so I love working with Jerry Trimble Jr., who is ex-Golden Boys, 3-time world champion kickboxer, now a fabulous actor. I've worked him probably in everything I can for the last 8 or 9 years. A tremendous actor, like a young Kirk Douglas, who's in the package. He's the blonde, spiky-haired guy that fights with Steve in the alleyway. Keith David, Eric Roberts, Bakun Woodbine. These are cats who I just truly enjoy working with, and they come to the table with ideas, with opinions, and with thoughts. Russ McCall, and that's important. That's important for pushing. It's not through laziness. It's through an exciting work, environment, and coming up with fresh ideas. I think it's very, very important. I agree with you guys. But predominantly, I think you're talking more from an action standpoint, right?
Yeah, but I mean, even people like Scorsese and De Niro did their best work together, that kind of thing, or even someone who does sort of dopey comedy, someone like Kevin Smith, who for the first part of his career did dopey comedies, he worked with the same people again and again and again, and it adds so much to that, I think.
No, it really does. I'd hope they'd had a relationship with Stone Cold. We had three more projects that we jumped through the hoops on. You know, I was flown out to New Orleans. We were prepping a film for a month and a half. But it was just one of those sad situations. The films, you know, didn't get financed and fell apart. Bumbling producers that couldn't quite, you know, make the thing work on paper. And I think that frustrated him. And we're still pals, but I think he wrote me a very, very nice email and just saying he's loving what he's doing with his reality shows and, you know, feels that for the time being that's probably a safer place for him to be in terms of keeping the paychecks coming in, you know.
Right.
Which was very upsetting to me because I'd hoped we'd go straight into another action movie. I'd actually written something, you know, especially for him. So maybe that'll happen.
Yeah.
But with regard to, you know, any of these guys, you know, certainly Scott, who, you know, this would be the second time I've worked with him, if we managed to get this picture going and Matthias Hughes, who I love working with, is another guy that sort of vanished for a few years, but is phenomenally talented, big martial arts, big guy who can just move like a guy a third of his size.
Yeah.
You know, these guys are cool cats to have around. So yeah, no, definitely agree with you. You know, need to find that alliance and make it work. Ross McCall is fantastic. He's less of an action star, but he's very good with the movement. You know, with that stuff, incredibly good.
Well, I mean, and I'm glad you sort of bring up Steve Austin, but also the idea that it's not always just about the action. Because one of my favorite films of yours is definitely The Package. I think you got a great and different performance out of both Steve Austin and Dolph Lundgren. I mean, I both saw them do things in that movie that I hadn't really seen them do before.
Thank you very much for noticing. I worked really, really hard on that.
Yeah.
To get Steve to wear that suit at the beginning was one of the toughest things imaginable. Oh, yeah. And, you know, I could spec some computer to show him what it looked like. I said, you've got to, you know, I want you to look slightly different for this. I want you to look, you know, cut nicely. And even for the rest of the movie, we put him in a designer outfit with a black V-neck. And it was, you know, because his default position is a baseball hat and a camouflage, you know, hunting jacket, you know, which is what he really, you know, really feels comfortable with. And, you know, there was lots of talk of, well, my fans aren't going to expect, you know, they're not going to like it like this. I said, just trust me. Let's do something a little different. And for him, that was a huge risk to take, and my respect. I have a lot of respect for somebody who takes a risk, and he knew he was going out of his familiar territory. He was going somewhere that was, and to the average film goer, they're like, oh, you just wear a different outfit. The director's going to tell him what to wear, and that's it. It doesn't work like that at all.
Yeah.
No, you are the lesser commodity as a director on a picture like that.
Steve Austin's a brand. Steve.
Yeah, they're not going to replace Steve. Guess who they're going to replace if things don't work?
Yeah, but in a weird way, that fear in him or that risk that he took, it translated into a sort of a weirdly soulful performance. There's some real depth to he did in an odd way.
Oh, I'm so pleased you noticed that. I'm so thrilled. Thank you very, very much. That was exactly what they're trying to do, to come up with something a little vulnerable, and it's tough because he's, you know, he's an incredible human specimen. How could I make this guy vulnerable? And the only way I could think of was with this wonderful wife and this sort of relationship here and this brother who's a complete waste of space and, you know, but loves him and respects him. And now you're starting to chip away at him psychologically, and he becomes a little bit vulnerable because physically, if you look at Steve Austin, this is a guy that you could never, ever buy as being vulnerable. You can't play him as an alcoholic because he clearly works out every day. And an alcoholic who's in a state of repair doesn't work out every day. You know? So you've got very limited means to giving him some kind of... And obviously you don't really have a character if you don't have some kind of vulnerability. You know? So it was fun doing that. And I think he enjoyed it. He told me he had a blast. And we will do it again, I think. It's going to happen. We talk quite regularly, and he's got, I think we'll be able to tempt him back into doing pictures. It just needs to be the right project.
Let's hope so. But no, I mean, I get it. I get frustrated all the time because you hear critics reviewing action movies and they just go, oh, it's the same thing. He's doing the same thing. He's doing the same thing. And, you know, Jason Statham's another one that gets that leveled at him all the time. But you see some of the movies he's done, especially the ones, weirdly, he shoots in England, like Blitz or Redemption or Hummingbird, as it was called. He does that like Steve Austin did in The Package. He does that. Not afraid to be beaten up, not afraid to be soulful, not afraid to have an inner monologue. Like, there's so much more to these actors than what most people normally credit them with, and it's such a shame.
It's frustrating to me. It's very frustrating. And to me, it makes me believe to a degree that people don't read film history books. Because
right.
if you pick up a book of film reviews from the 1970s, you'll see that they're reaming Clint Eastwood. They're reaming Steve McQueen. They're reaming Charles Bronson. He can't act. He's terrible. Same monotone, cranky-faced guy at the front of the film. He doesn't do anything different. All he is this. You go back to the 60s and the 50s. They're reaming John Wayne. They're reaming Humphrey right. Bogart. They're reaming Jimmy Cagney. And it's like, well, you know, have you noticed the theme here, guys? You don't like action heroes.
Yeah.
You think they don't do much. And then as 30, 40 years go by, people look back and go, oh, God, he was incredible. Wasn't he wonderful? Didn't he bring interesting nuance? He played himself, but he played himself so well. That's exactly what Jason Statham's doing now. That's exactly what, you know, Stone Cold's doing. They are playing themselves. They know their instrument. There are variations to it. It's subtle, but they're not going to come in there and, you know, play a clown jumping around, you know, and you know, although some of them can, you know, Mark Dacascos can, you know, right. he has talent. There's a true Shakespearean actor, and some of them do. But yeah, it's amusing to me, you know, and you can't take too much notice of it. You know?
And just to let you know, obviously, we had the very talented and very sadly departed Darren Shalavi on the show. And when we spoke to him, he had nothing but praise for you and the film, The Package, and seemed incredibly proud of it, especially compared to some other straight-to-DVD films he'd been doing recently. He was very proud of it.
I just love Darren. I was heartbroken by it. It was a very... very sad affair, you know. I'll never forget, because we were in a room at the Roosevelt Hotel with his family. It was myself, Michael Jai White, four or five stuntmen, Lionel Stovall, who's one of, you know, the best fight guys in the business at the moment, Ernie Barber Action, and there wasn't a dry eye in this. Everyone was crying, and it was an extraordinary, extraordinary sad, you know, sad thing, and it just one of those incredible. Awful moments that you do anything in the world to change, you know. It just doesn't make sense. And the only thing I can attribute it to, because we all look for reasons when something like this happens, is it's just a very, very tough game. And he was the same age as me. He was 42, 43. And to keep up at that level that Darren was at, he was always obsessed with being better than the competition. And in his case, the competition was 21 years old. You know, guys coming in straight out of gym, you know, and who can do standing double backflips. And Darren was obsessed with being not only as good as them, but being better than them in every respect. And he was working out way more than he should have done. And you know, he had an hip injury. And, I mean, it's just, you know, that he should have fixed a long time ago. And, it was an absolute testament to the incredible person that he was, you know, that it happened that way. I mean, and people... diminish that, you know, the hard work that these guys do to star in these pictures. Steve Austin, every bone in his body is broken. He can't straighten his right arm because the tendons replaced. He has cadaver tendons in his knee. You know, he broke his neck and his skull. And this is for your performance. This is what this guy has gone through to entertain you, you know. Scott Adkins, incredible punishment Scott Adkins does to himself to do these kicks. You know, what he's doing, the aerial work, the 720s, the 510s. And, I mean, these are incredibly punishing, but he does them to entertain, and it's for your benefit. It's you know, it's incredible. It's, you know, and it's just very, very hard on a person. And, you know, Darren was a good enough actor. He could have relied on his acting skills at this point in his career, I believe, and just kept the martial arts to a certain degree. But he was so desperate to show that he could do that and do it better, and he did, you know.
Yeah.
Mentally and physically.
Oh yeah, from his earliest films and right through, he was always a joy to watch and had some incredible moves. So a real shame. But no, I just saw recently there's an article that the John Wick directors have talked about again, and this is something that comes up. You know, there's no stunt awards. There's no awards for us. There's no Oscar for stunt people. Jason Statham said the same thing. There's no awards or things for other stunt people or martial artists or, you know, those guys.
Sadly, there's a very, very straightforward explanation for that. And until we come up with I think I've come up with a way of doing it. The explanation why there isn't an action award is because it would detract from the director's award for that picture. Because if you felt that another person was in charge of creating perhaps the most commercial aspect to that film or memorable aspect to that film, that would take away from his position. And you're never going to make someone happy about that, you know. And at the moment, the director credit is one of the most important there. So the only way to do that is if you give an action award, it goes to the stunt coordinator, second unit director, and the director.
Right.
And you would you would do that, and then at that point you're appeasing the ego of the director, and that's the only way you're ever going to get it, because, I mean, it's not like a makeup award. You know, if you take the best makeup or the best sound or the best camera work, you're not stealing any of the glory from that director. You know what I mean? But if you make the Bourne Supremacy, and then that wins a second unit directing award, that second unit director has just benefited. And at the end of the day, what did the director do? If he didn't do the action, he did those 4.5 minutes worth of dialogue. You know, people are going to, you know, it sort of makes sense to me. You have to imagine the incredible egos that are in control at the level that we're talking about, you know?
Yeah, of course.
I think you're not going to see a stunt Oscar, or an action Oscar, until you include the first unit director within that category. And then he gets it, and he's like, oh, this is fantastic. He'll go up and he'll get his chance at the podium and say, well, I didn't win the best director Oscar, but my film won best action, and here I am with my share of the Oscar, you know? That way you're going to have some leverage. You're going to be able to move forward, but it's going to be a tough one otherwise.
That's a really good idea, though. Do like what they do with the best movie, and they have all the producers up.
Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
Do it with it. Yeah, that would be a much better way. That would be great.
You have to. Otherwise, it will never happen. There's a reason it hasn't happened. There's a funny anecdote about John Ford and Stagecoach with what's the name? The stunt man on that one. Yakimark and the producer was watching dailies with John Ford and Yak, and they watched this incredible stunt that he did, you know, when he went under the horses, and he directed second unit for that sequence as well. And the producer at the back of the theatre clapped his hands and said, Yak, you've made the movie fantastic. And in his biography, Yakimark Canutt said that he looked forward and saw John Ford just look over his shoulder just slightly and then look back again. And he said that was the last film I ever did with John Ford.
Oh, wow.
Because the director had just given the credit for the movie to the stunt coordinator.
Right.
And that's what you're always going to be running into with any kind of award that you're going to give to stuntmen. You're always going to be dealing with the incredible ego required of a director at that level, you know. Anyway,
right.
that's my shot. And but back to the basics of it, yes, absolutely, there should be something that recognizes the work and the effort and the energy and the scientific skill that went into it. And what always frustrates me is when you watch the best Oscar for sound effects editing, they always show the action sequence from the film.
Right, exactly.
And it's like, do you honestly think that was the reason that sequence looks good?
Yeah.
But that's all right. That's my personal.
No, I completely agree. Yeah.
I agree with that. So you did the DC comic short movies, Lobo and Wonder Woman, which were great. Were these done for fun, or were these to show studios what you could do?
There's an Isaac Florentine will echo this. There's incredible snobbery within the studio system. We all want to be directing films for the studio, but no one wants to direct to DVD movies. The money's not good enough. The films are tough to make wonderful. They're very, very hard work to make good. So everyone wants to make studio movies. But no studio will hire a director based upon his direct-to-DVD movies. It just won't happen. It is just not going to happen, because as opposed to hiring someone who's never directed anything, in their eyes, you have proven you can direct, but you can only direct a film that went to DVD, which means that it's lesser a risk for them to hire someone off the street who's never even directed a movie. And that's the strange methodology behind it. My managers said, you know, Kaylee Marsh is fabulous and has, you know, understands the studio system very, very well. Said, look, if this is what you really want to do, you have to direct a short film that they can watch in 2 minutes, which blows them away. And
like a showreel.
Let them know that, yes, exactly. Let them know that you're someone that can do something of the level that they're at. You know, so choose something a little bit interesting. And at the time, no one had done Wonder Woman. The only thing you had was the awful, awful TV show that was, I mean, if you look at it now, it's possibly the most dated TV show imaginable. I mean, it's really, really corny and cheesy. And that was the only thing that was out there. They tried to do the Adrian Palicki thing, but it, you know, had been cut off at pilot stage. And, So I decided, let's go back to basics. You know, she's a warrior woman. Let's hire a real martial artist. You know, Nina was a bare knuckle fighter before she became a singer. Let's hire a real martial artist. Scar her up. Make her look like a fighter. Forget the big tits and forget all that crappy sexist stuff that, you know, from the 50s and 60s. And let's make her into a badass chick that looks like she'd actually knock you out. give them an outfit that's all scraped up and cut and dirty and greasy and looks like it's been through a battle or two, and let's put them up against the Nazis, you know. And I thought it was a fun idea, but went out and did it, and it was enormously popular. And I think I had more meetings based upon that short than all 10 of my direct-to-DVD movies combined.
Yeah, my next question was going to be, you know, Kevin Smith recently stated that you should get the Wonder Woman gig. And did that give you a confidence boost? And did you get any contact from anybody in the studio
system? Get me an ego boost. confidence is pretty solid as it is. But it was lovely. It was a really, really wonderful thing for him to do. And it just proved there's another cool cat out there. You know, there's not many cats directors that go out on a limb and say things like that. And he's awesome. And what a fantastic thumbs up to get from someone. Validation, you know, how really cool is that? So very, very fun. I think it contributed to a lot of interest. And, you know, I'm in a position at the moment where there's tons of projects almost there. You know what I mean? I think we've got about 8 at the moment. I talked to my manager last night about it, that are all in front of me with great actors attached. Great projects, and I'm in the running. We're not sure, is it going to go? Is it going to go this way? Is it going to go that way? And in the meantime, you know, you just have to keep forging ahead with your own projects as well. For example, the one with Scott that we're trying to put together. If a studio picture comes, it's awesome. And at that point, we're in the running. It's like a small community, and then you get into that community. But you know, if you look at these guys that have these huge studio pictures, some of them have failure after failure after failure. But because they're within that. Sacrosanct group, they seem to keep existing, and you're either in it or you're out of it, and that's the end goal, is to get within that, you know, that small fraternity, you know.
Yeah.
And they're there, the projects are there, and I can taste them, and I'm talking to the right people and meeting with the right people based on the Wonder Woman, based on the track record, based on the high level of the stunt coordinating and second unit work that's there. But in the meantime, as I say, I'm going to keep forging through really, really cool action, which is what I love, you know.
Yeah, no, definitely. And so just to sort of wind it up then, you obviously love action movies, but you also show in your films drama and strong performances and interesting photography and so on. Obviously, you're saying that you want to continue on that path, but what new things are you looking to bring to the genre, and is there any other genres you'd like to tackle or anything else you'd like to do going forward?
I don't really think it's all story-driven. You know, it's absolutely, you know, the script is wonderful. You go to it. And then the one thing I will say is that to do good action, when people say they love the action in a movie, what they really mean is they loved the story. They loved the movie, and the action was great. You know, people say, oh, give me a car chase like in Bullet. Give me a fight scene like in Fight Club. Give me, you know, and then you break down. The car chase in Bullet is 5 minutes, but you've got a half-hour build-up, you know, and you've got this wonderful character, and you're into it, and you're watching it. By the time the car chase comes, you're actually on the edge of your seat anyway. And in Fight Club, the same thing. It's a minuscule compared with the build-up and the character. And if you knit that beautiful story together and create characters that you're involved in and invested in, and there's a real sense of jeopardy and a real sense of drama, by the time you show that action scene, if it's a well-made action scene, you've got them. You've got the audience. It's a wonderful thing, you know. So for me, story is always first. Story, and then story. And once that's solid, the action speaks for itself. And I adore action. I like the adrenaline flow that you get in the movie theater. I want to see the audience leaning forwards, edging towards the front of their seat. You know what I mean? That tense position you get. Yeah. I don't know if you guys saw American Sniper, but I just loved watching the audience in that picture, you know. While the film was playing out, I was looking over everyone as they're leaning forward, completely still, no one's shifting position at all, you know, no one coughing. They're there, and they're in the trenches with this guy. It's such a visceral experience, and, you know, that's 3D filmmaking for me, not goggles, you know, not, you know, 3D filmmaking is putting the audience in that environment in a way that they can't argue with. You've got them, you know, got them by the nose, you know. And that's what's exciting to me. And action is my way of doing that because I adore it. But yes, it emanates from story. Genre, love to do a Western.
That would be amazing.
I'm an English boy that played cowboys and came to America. I want to do a Western. I will do one. I think I have this a music video coming up after this one I do next week, which is a country and western, and it gives me a chance finally to play with that genre. But yeah,
nice.
My office is full of all of that kind of memorabilia and books on the Old West and old photographs, the old tintypes.
And have you been out to sort of Monument Valley or Old Tucson or anywhere like that?
Every time I can. I've worked in Utah twice and visited the Circles National Park there, and just adore it. When I was a kid, Almeria, and obviously the sets where they shot the dollar westerns. And,
oh, in Spain, yeah.
Love that genre at some point, Will, and hoping that, this next one from Tarantino. I know it's Tarantino, so it's difficult to set a trend with him because it looks like plagiarism, but hopefully it sets some kind of a trend for films of that genre that can make money and that backers start to say, perhaps there is a life in a Western, beyond just Quentin's movies,
They've done some stuff on TV, and there's the odd one that comes out sort of here
Deadwood
and there,
and
things like that. So, I think it's a genre that keeps trying to resurface. It keeps having these spurts, but hopefully it will. Hopefully they'll move into that. Obviously at the moment,
I love the Second World War. I have, it's always interesting to me. There's lots of stories. I'm not sure how feasible that is. I have a autobiography on my desk at the moment, and an unpublished galley from a Korean officer, an officer who was in the Korean War, an American officer, which is a fabulous, hair-raising story. And I feel, we're losing vets from the Korean War at an incredible rate at the moment. And I think it was extraordinarily violent, extraordinarily personal experience, and just epic in story scope. And in recent times, if you discount Korean, South Korean movies that were made about the war, there's really been nothing done that's explored that. And I think while we still have those vets, and we can show some sort of an appreciation, have some kind of first-hand evidence, and have some kind of tie-in that could honor them, I think there's a movie there that really needs to be made. So I'm hoping I get something, after I finish the book, there's something in there that I can maybe take a chapter, maybe make into a movie, work something there.
That would be great.
Because, you could film one of those here, and I think that's something that could be, it was a brutal, brutal war, fought in the snow in sub-zero conditions with almost World War II era technology. And, it was before, Vietnam, so everything was still very, very rudimentary in terms of communications and firepower. And you had basically, battles, of attrition, and that's always interesting, I think, in movie terms.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, that sounds fantastic.
Cool. Awesome. Well, really, really fun talking to you. Thank you so much for calling me, and thank you for the nice words about my movies. You can't imagine how happy that makes me feel that there's people that are enjoying it.
Congratulations on all your movies and everything yet to come, sir.
Thank you very much, and really good talking to you both. You please keep in touch, and if there's anything I can provide beyond this, go check out the Beautiful Ones trailer. Let me know what you think of that. That's on my site.
We should post that. And I met Scott Adkins last year at a convention, and he said that he'd come on the show. So if you just give him a nudge for us, please, Jesse.
I will do. I'll mention that this morning. I'm heading over there in about 40 minutes, for sure.
Doc's always the one that asks the ballsy question. Anyway, have a good day, man, and take care, and thanks ever so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Take care, guys.
See you later.
Bye.